Captain's Log, Stardate 21 March 2013, Thursday's NPR News Update. Today, a journey to the state legislature for a look at another gun bill, a smaller funding pie for the Department of Health and Human Services, and a new health insurance exchange law. And is there soil still beneath that snow? And will it bring forth sustenance this year? We'll tackle that. First, a New Prague middle schooler faces juvenile detention after police say he phoned 911 and falsely reported a shooting at the New Prague middle school yesterday. The incident was just a hoax, but it offers a glimpse at how Minnesota schools are prepared to react to dangerous situations, something that's been heightened since the school shootings in Connecticut 4 months ago. Here's our Tim Post.
Wednesday's incident began with a 7:55 a.m. prank call to 911. A caller claimed there had been a shooting at the New Prague Middle School. As officers from several area communities headed to the scene, the district's six buildings went into the highest level of lockdown, a code red. Superintendent Larry Kozlerich says it all happened very quickly.
I went out into halls and I watched how quickly that code red came. Our staff and students reacted and they closed those doors, turned off the lights, and it was dead silence in there.
14-year-old 8th grader Miles Mischke heard the code red announcement over the school's PA system.
Well, we were going to the gym and then heard about it over the intercom, so we went to our weight room and pretty much sat there for 2 hours.
From a student's view, Miles says everything went smoothly.
Pretty good. Everybody was quiet and kept calm.
8th grader Rosie Freges says she and a few other students were cleaning up after an Honor Society breakfast when they heard the code red announcement. They hid in a nearby classroom, something they'd been taught to do.
Yeah, we've practiced it many times.
All Minnesota schools must have a safety plan in place and are required to run through drills at least 5 times a year. As police began their investigation in two middle school buildings, word of the lockdown went out to parents from students via their cell phones. It also spread to social media sites and news websites before school officials were able to alert parents. Word of the lockdown wasn't posted on the New Prague Middle School website, and it didn't make it onto the district site until well after the incident occurred. Parents did receive automated calls from the district, but some say that happened after they got the news from other sources. Rich Novak arrived at the school just after 9 a.m., hoping to pick up his 8th grade daughter.
The notification from the school actually didn't come out until, I know it was like right before 9 o'clock, and I have a brother and a sister-in-law that were down in Florida on vacation, and they contacted me before the school even notified us.
Superintendent Kozlerich says the district's notification system is fairly responsive, but it can't beat texting teens.
Children have cell phones. They're calling mom and dad right away.
A quick investigation by police discovered the shooting call was a hoax, and they took a 12-year-old boy into custody. Law enforcement officials say he used a disabled cell phone that was only able to dial 911. Just after 10 a.m., 2 hours after the code red went into effect, parents were allowed to take students home. Classes were dismissed for the rest of the day. New Prague Police Chief Mike Vosepka told reporters during a news conference that overall the school handled the lockdown well.
It went very smooth. They did a very good job, and all the students are safe. No one was injured in this incident whatsoever.
Wednesday's incident comes as Governor Dayton is proposing to reopen a school safety center within the Department of Public Safety and open a new school climate center at the Department of Education. The department's chief of staff, Charlene Briner, says the two centers would provide schools with resources and training on how to deal with emergencies.
Working in tandem to really kind of create a proactive approach so we're not dealing with these sort of situations, real or otherwise.
Briner says schools walk a fine line in preparing for dangerous situations. They want students to know how to best react, but at the same time, school officials don't want to worry parents and students about the safety of their schools.
Education reporter Tim Post. School safety and gun violence are still a hot topic at the state capitol. A day after a key lawmaker abandoned his push for universal background checks for gun buyers, House DFLers are now planning to expand background checks only to private sales that occur at gun shows. Lawmakers are working on a revamped bill that will also include some provisions popular with Republicans and more conservative Democrats. The bill is scheduled for a hearing tonight. Brant Williams reports.
House Democrats say the latest version of gun legislation will be shaped by adding gun show background checks and other new language to a bill proposed earlier this session by DFL Representative John Lesh of St. Paul. The Lesch bill expands the list of offenses that will make a person ineligible to possess a firearm. The bill forbids people ineligible to carry firearms from also possessing ammunition. And the bill also includes tougher penalties for people who provide guns to people who are legally prohibited from having them. Lesch says his bill includes recommendations from county prosecutors and has broad support.
It's my prosecutor's bill, I can't remember the bill number, but from earlier in session, that was roundly lauded in committee by Representative Cornish and all the members. The only addition would be the closure of the gun show loophole.
Lesch is referring to Republican Tony Cornish of Good Thunder. Cornish says he does support tougher penalties for gun offenders. However, he opposes requiring background checks for private sales at gun shows. Cornish told NPR News that requiring background checks at gun shows will only inconvenience law-abiding gun owners and will not keep criminals from getting guns.
You know, what are they really stopping? All of the shootings that we've seen lately are people that have had legal firearms or have stolen or have borrowed from their mom and dad.
Cornish and other opponents of universal background checks also say the state's background check system has too many gaps. And they say it makes no sense to strain the system with more requests when it doesn't do a good enough job of catching people who shouldn't be able to buy firearms. DFL Representative Deborah Hillstrom of Brooklyn Center proposed a bill to help repair gaps in the state system. It gained the support of Cornish and other Republicans. Hillstrom says parts of her bill will likely be included in the latest House gun bill.
And then I anticipate, pieces of my bill will be offered as an amendment. Pieces to put things in or take things out will all be offered by someone. You never know who or what.
After the House bill is crafted, there is still the matter of what happens in the Senate. DFL Senator Ron Latz of St. Louis Park, who supports universal background checks, is the main sponsor of the companion to Lesch's House bill. He says he doesn't want to talk about possible changes to his bill until he sees what comes out of the House. Latz also won't say if he'd accept the House bill's more narrow background check provision in order to get something passed. But he says background checks are a vital piece of any gun-related legislation.
All of those other provisions, helpful as they would be, will have a tiny impact on reducing gun violence in comparison to the extension of background checks to all private sales.
Latz notes that local and national polls show widespread public support for universal background checks. Among the supporters is DFL Governor Mark Dayton. While Dayton will not get to sign a bill this session containing universal background checks, he says requiring background checks for private sales at gun shows is, in his words, better than nothing.
That's Brant Williams in Minneapolis. Democrats in the Minnesota House and Senate are proposing more than $2 billion in new taxes to erase the budget deficit and spend more on schools, economic development, and other state services. But there's one area of the budget that is not getting an increase: health and human services. In fact, DFLers are proposing a spending cut for that department, and Tom Scheck says some advocates for the poor say they can't handle any more spending reductions.
Democrats in the House and Senate want to cut $150 million in spending from health and human services programs. After education, health and human services is the second largest portion of the state's two-year budget at $11 billion in general fund spending. But it's increasing at a fast rate, and that worries DFL House Speaker Paul Thiessen.
This is the part of the budget that keeps me up at night, because it is the thing that if we don't continue to do the reforms and find the efficiencies in this system, we won't be able to provide the services that people in Minnesota expect.
The proposed spending cut is troubling lawmakers in charge of crafting the health and human services budget. They have to set priorities for spending for nursing homes, hospitals, subsidized health insurance, and welfare. The budget is complicated because it includes federal money and money from other funds. DFL Representative Tom Huntley of Duluth, who chairs the House Health and Human Services Finance Committee, says he's not happy about the spending target, especially since it comes after Governor Dayton and the Republican-controlled legislature cut $1.2 billion from health and human services programs 2 years ago.
Well, I'm very upset. I came close to resigning as chair. If that's what the Democrats are going to do, then what's the difference between that and what the Republicans have done in the last 2 years?
Huntley says about 90% of the health and human services budget is directed at programs for the disabled and the elderly. He says he thinks it will be difficult to cut $150 million without harming those people.
We all go home in May, and our lives go on, but there'll be people that will be suffering because of what we're going to do with this budget.
Huntley admitted he has no good ideas as to how to make his budget work, but says he's considering cutting some payments to hospitals, creating surcharges on health care providers, and finding other fees to reach the target. DFL Senator Tony Laurie of Carrick, who chairs the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Committee, declined to comment when asked about the cut. Republican Representative Jim Abler of Anoka says he was shocked when he saw the budget target. Abler, who chaired the House Health and Human Services Finance Committee when the Republicans were in charge, says he never thought Democrats would raise taxes and yet cut the human services budget.
They're raising billions of dollars and putting it everywhere, you know, to the courts and environment, and those are wonderful, but there's only one part of government where people could die, and that's in our area, where you have the people with disabilities and health care and the rural hospitals. And I was just really, really surprised. Nobody I know saw that coming.
Organizations lobbying on behalf of hospitals, nursing homes, the elderly, and the disabled are now shifting their lobbying strategy from calling for more money to protecting what they have. Bruce Nelson is the CEO of the Association of Residential Resources in Minnesota that advocates for community living for people with disabilities. He says he was hoping lawmakers would give nursing home and community-based home workers a cost of living increase. Now he's worried they won't get a raise or may get their pay cut.
When they don't see an increase in their paychecks for maybe now a fifth year in a row, they're going to move on to other jobs. And that really does compromise the quality of care for our most vulnerable citizens.
DFL leaders in the House and Senate say they believe they can make the cuts without harming vulnerable people. They say placing a surcharge on nursing homes and hospitals and using a surplus from the Minnesota Care Fund are two options. They also say changes under the federal health care law will help the state save money. Governor Dayton's budget plan spends $170 million more on health and human services programs.
That's Tom Scheck at the state capitol. Governor Dayton held a standing room only town hall meeting in Duluth last night to discuss his budget proposal. Dan Crocker was there.
Dayton's plan would raise an estimated $1.1 billion in new revenue by hiking taxes on that top 2%. He wants that money to help plug a $627 million projected state deficit. And among other investments, he's proposing to increase education funding by $640 million. That's welcome news to Bill Grunseth, superintendent of the Duluth Public Schools. He said the Duluth district is facing a $3.5 million deficit this year.
Your budget proposal does help us a little bit on that. Doesn't get us all the way, but I like the long-range view of your budget with education.
Dayton answered questions for an hour and a half, ranging from health care to environmental regulations to one question on guns, which the governor called a bogus issue.
Nobody's going to confiscate your guns. Nobody. I swear, I give you my word. You put every dollar I possess on the table. No one's going to confiscate anybody's guns.
Afterwards, Charlie Fedora of Duluth, an independent who did not vote for Dayton in 2010, said he thought the governor performed well.
He was responsive to the people that were here. He was cordial. There was a couple incidences where things were starting to get out of hand, and he put a squash to it, which I thought was good.
Dayton plans to host three additional budget conversations across the state in Moorhead, St. Cloud, and Rochester. Meanwhile, the Democrats who control the state legislature have different ideas on how much revenue to raise and where to spend it. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
A centerpiece of President Obama's health care overhaul is now law in Minnesota. Governor Dayton has signed the Health Insurance Exchange Bill. It creates a new marketplace for health insurance, and the administration gave it a new name called MinSure. That's M-N-S-U-R-E. Starting in October, Elizabeth Stawicki says more than 1 million Minnesotans, including 300,000 uninsured, are expected to shop and sign up for health plans using MinSure.
After exchange legislation stalled for 2 years when the GOP controlled the legislature, the DFL pushed a bill through this year with remarkable speed. The legislation hit the governor's desk in plenty of time to meet state and federal deadlines. As Governor Dayton sat down to sign the bill in the Capitol's Great Hall, about 50 lawmakers, cabinet members, and staff quieted down for the moment the sweeping new law took effect while cameras clicked away. As the governor stood up and pushed his chair away, he got a thank you from the bill's Senate sponsor, Tony Lorie, a DFLer from Carrick. Lorie, who said he got choked up watching the governor sign the bill into law, called it a big deal.
This is a big deal for our people, for our families, for our small businesses that have struggled to find affordable health care options for the people of Minnesota.
The final version of the bill passed without a single GOP vote, capping 3 years of staunch Republican opposition to the idea of an insurance exchange, as it's been called. While Lorie was emotional, the bill's House sponsor, Inver Grove Heights DFLer Joe Atkins, joked about how hard it was to shepherd the legislation to passage.
I literally just had a filling put in at the dentist without Novocaine because I was a little afraid. I didn't want to come here and drool all over, but it was actually a little less painful than going through the legislative process.
Jokes aside, Atkins said Republicans made many important contributions to the bill. Even though they didn't vote for it, Atkins said they did great work in beefing up privacy protections and oversight provisions. And he said the result will provide consumers with a convenient way to buy health insurance online and a level playing field with health insurers.
Literally, at this point in time, health carriers will have to compete more fiercely than they ever have in the last 50 or 100 years for consumers' business. And that's not something we have ever seen in Minnesota before.
Julie Bruner of the trade organization that represents Minnesota's health insurers, the Council of Health Plans, took exception to that comment, saying competition is fierce now.
I know from talking to salespeople in the health plans that they will frequently see a business make a change from one carrier to another carrier for a 1% difference in premium.
Bruner is warning that the exchange's current structure may backfire. She says insurance will cost more, meaning the number of people without insurance may grow, not shrink. Whether that scenario or the state's less pessimistic forecast comes to pass is just one of the many questions about MinSure that remain to be answered. Among them, whom will Dayton appoint to the powerful board overseeing the marketplace? Will insurers balk and refuse to offer plans for sale on MinSure? How many uninsured people will refuse to buy insurance and pay the federal fine instead? And will MinSure's massive IT system actually work when they flip the switch next October? But today's bill signing eliminates one question. Minnesota has now joined at least 17 other states in choosing to have its own exchange, rather than having to accept one built and run by the federal government.
Elizabeth Stewicki there, now Stephanie Hemphill. She says a bill to create model standards for frac sand mining has cleared another hurdle in the Senate.
Senator Matt Schmidt has several bills on silica sand mining. This one mirrors a bill making its way through the House. It would set up a technical advisory council to help local governments deal with health and environmental questions about a form of mining that's growing because of the sand's use in hydraulic fracturing for oil and gas. Schmidt says neither the state nor local governments are ready for a rapid increase in permit requests for new mines.
All you have to do is look over to Wisconsin and see just 2 years ago there was a small handful of mining permit requests. And 2 years later, we have over 100 mining operations.
Industry critics say existing state rules and local land use controls are adequate, and they worry that added regulations could make their operations uncompetitive. Stephanie Hemphill, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota's economy added 14,500 jobs last month, and January's tally was revised upward by another 1,400 jobs. That means the state is just 1,000 jobs shy of the previous peak in February of 2008, early in the Great Recession. The state's unemployment rate held steady at 5.5% in February. The U.S. jobless rate last month was 7.7%. It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Part of the right field wall at Duluth's Wade Stadium collapsed last night. Duluth Huskies owner Mike Rosenzweig says a large piece of the brick wall had been bowing out away from the playing field for about 5 years, and he thinks the freeze-thaw cycle this spring finally proved too much for the Depression-era construction.
Mother Nature just won. It finally came tumbling down, and it took out... it certainly took out the bowed area, and then along with it, It ran about 100, I don't know, people are saying between 100 and 200 feet down that right field wall, but everything fell out. Nothing fell into the stadium.
Rosenzweig says the collapse wasn't near the playing field or the grandstand. He hopes the city will be able to salvage the bricks and make repairs, but he says he's confident the municipal stadium will be ready for the Huskies' opener on June 1st. Let's play ball. Utility and fire crews worked late into the night to repair a water main break near the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth last night. There was no damage to the college or nearby homes. A water pipe break last week in downtown Duluth flooded the Radisson Hotel. Officials say the hotel will remain closed until May. The start of spring means the crop planting season is not far away. And while the two-year drought is a big worry, there have been signs of hope recently. Precipitation has increased, and that's helped boost farmers' outlook for this year's crop. Here's our Mark Style.
Stroll along Alan Roloff's driveway, and you'll hear the sound of relief. Soggy gravel, water splashing, and even honest-to-goodness mud underfoot. The rain and snow that soaked this driveway has Roloff's thinking that the drought will disappear just as surely as the snow.
We had a really nice rain here last week, Saturday. My neighbor put his rain gauge out, and he had a little over 8 tenths.
That's a big change from a year ago when things were dry and abnormally warm. Then the family garden sprouted radishes by the end of March. That's not going to happen this year.
Now you have to use a pickaxe to chop through the ice to plant it.
The change in the weather has the 63-year-old Roloff feeling good about the coming crop year. Bolstering that expectation is the forecast from a private weather company he follows, predicting above normal spring rains.
And then after that, they're expecting a more warm and moist summer than usual, which would be totally ideal for raising a good crop.
Officially, most of Minnesota is still locked in drought. But farmers are hoping for wetter weather as eagerly as nearly everyone is waiting for the first signs of spring. Signs of spring are scarce, but farmers are having better luck with the drought.
Should be getting better, especially with a pretty good snowpack there in much of the state.
That's Climate Prediction Center meteorologist David Miskus' outlook for the drought in Minnesota. Miskus says the worst U.S. drought conditions have moved west in the last 6 months or so. So much so that some of the driest areas last summer, like Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio, are almost drought-free now.
We've gotten more storm systems coming into the central part of the country right now, bringing more snow and rain, and a lot more colder air coming down in out of Canada. So definitely a pattern change compared to last year.
No one knows for sure if the drought will reassert itself, but grain traders are also thinking the change in the weather pattern is for real and will benefit U.S. crops. You can see it in corn prices. Right now, corn is relatively scarce. Prices are high, around $7.30 a bushel. But the price of corn to be delivered next December is about 25% less. That reflects industry expectations that better weather and more planted acres will make corn far more abundant by December, so those prices have fallen. Wells Fargo agricultural economist Michael Swanson says prices could go even lower than the current December market of about $5.60 a bushel.
If we start seeing better soil moisture and a better weather pattern outlook, it's clearly going to go into the low fours.
Swanson says for farmers, a large harvest and the resulting price drop would not necessarily be a disaster. The extra corn might be worth enough to offset lower prices. Swanson says, though, farmers can protect themselves and lock in today's higher prices by pre-selling some of the coming crop before prices go lower. But he fears recent history will prevent many farmers from taking that precaution.
The last 3 years, anybody's pre-sold corn hasn't been the smartest person at the coffee shop.
Last year is a good example. Like now, on the eve of planting, traders expected a big crop. But when the drought took hold, corn prices soared to record levels. That meant almost unheard-of profits for everyone who waited to sell. Those who did pre-sell in the spring made less. Southwest Minnesota farmer Alan Roloffs is one farmer who doesn't like to sell corn early. He says he wants some indication about how big his harvest will be before making binding commitments. And his inkling is that improving weather will make this fall's crop a good one.
Right now, we definitely do not have drought on our mind.
The long wait for spring is even something that cheers Roloffs. Last year's abnormally warm March seemed, in retrospect, to predict the coming drought. So now Roloffs is hoping a more normal winter means more normal summer rain. And that's exactly what his land and crops need.
That's Mark Stile in Lincoln County. Phil Picardi here in Ramsey County, not near the Emerald City in the merry old land of Oz, but the Wizard of Wanamaker will have Minnesota's news on your schedule right here tomorrow. Come back again for the NPR News Update.